You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Ahead in the next 60 minutes, fixing Costa Cruises. How does a brand caught so adrift ever get back on course? We put the case for space, examining the argument for more investment in the US space program and the politics involved in such a decision.
We've lost our competitive edge intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, and I thought to myself, when did we last have that edge? And it was during the golden era of space exploration.
We'll be hearing what our design editor Hugo McDonald makes of Helsinki's plans for urban redevelopment.
In total, there's about 30 different projects that are going on simultaneously, which will, over the course of the next sort of 40 years, completely transform Helsinki.
Plus why Tesco's has been using some fruity language to describe the government of South Korea. And we take a look at the world of remote-controlled camel racing. That's all to come here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, let's get the latest news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Syrian authorities will let Red Cross aid workers enter the Baba Amra district of Homs tomorrow, according to a spokesman for the International Committee of the Red Cross. The move came as a three-week army siege of the neighbourhood appeared to be ending with the withdrawal of rebel forces. Syrian authorities also gave the ICRC positive indications on the agency's request for a daily two-hour ceasefire to deliver life-saving relief supplies to civilians. The green light came as Syrian rebels left Baba Amr after a 26-day military siege aimed at crushing a symbol of the revolt against President Bashar al-Assad. Speaking earlier on Monocle 24, Syrian writer and analyst Rima Alaf outlined the significance of the Free Syrian Army's action.
The Free Syrian Army is determined as well to try to do what it can to limit the damage done to Homs and also to encourage others to join the fight against the regime, to make them believe that if they stick together, they could do it without foreign intervention.
The UN has called for punishment for the US soldiers who burned copies of the Quran in Afghanistan. The burnings, which happened at a NATO airbase in Bagram, ignited a wave of anti-Western fury across the country. At least 30 people were killed in protests. President Obama sent a letter of apology to Afghan President Karzai last week, saying the burnings had been inadvertent and an error. But today, Jan Kubit, special representative for the UN Secretary General in Afghanistan, said there must be disciplinary action.
But I agree with those that are saying that after this apology and after the investigation, disciplinary action should follow. Those that were behind this grave mistake should be held accountable for it.
The European Union was set to make Serbia a candidate for membership today in an attempt to promote better government in the Western Balkans as it struggles to emerge from years of war in the 1990s. Serbia's application to join will be considered by EU leaders at an evening summit meeting in Brussels, and acceptance will launch a potentially lengthy process to bring the former Yugoslav Republic into the bloc. A year after the uprising that ousted President Mubarak, one of Egypt's longest-serving rulers since the pharaohs, there are undoubtedly fewer tourists for the souvenir touts to pursue around the Sphinx and pyramids in Giza. The political turmoil that has embroiled Egypt in the last year has scared some tourists away, denting a vital sector of the Egyptian economy. In Cairo's historic Khan el Khalili Bazaar, foreign tourists walk the narrow alleyways full of shops selling lanterns, copies of pharaonic items, silver and gold, and woven scarves. As the number of visitors has dwindled, the sales pitches have grown louder and more insistent. Danish national Lena has been in Cairo for 6 months.
It's very, very hard on the tourism that all the tourists stopped coming. I think a lot of people work in the tourism industry, and since everyone is gone now, you can also feel when you walk here that people are a bit more desperate, I think, than in the beginning when I came here.
Senegal's Youssou N'Dour has said he would relaunch his musical career with a victory concert for Macky Sall if the presidential challenger beats incumbent Abdoulaye Wade in an election runoff this month. Declaring his support for Sall, N'Dour said he would break his silence with a concert on April 4th, Senegal's Independence Day. And tired passengers left the crippled cruise ship in the Seychelles, capital Victoria, today, ending a three-day ordeal in the Indian Ocean after a fire knocked out the vessel's main power supply. More than half the 636 passengers on the Costa Concordia took up the offer of a 14-day holiday on the archipelago from the ship's owner, Costa Cruises, the same company whose giant liner Costa Concordia smashed into rocks off Italy in January. The passengers, including four children, are from 25 nations. The largest contingents are 127 from France and 126 from Italy. There are also 38 Germans, 31 Britons, 13 Canadians and 8 Americans. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. And before we go back to the Costa Cruises story, let's take a quick look at the headlines that are making the front pages of the papers in Australasia. The Sydney Morning Herald is leading with quite strangely, I must say, is an article from the British Medical Journal's magazine, the Journal of Medical Ethics, where a claim is made that mothers of children with serious abnormalities should have the chance to end a child's life after birth. Having said that, its main headline taking up the majority of the paper is to do with the number of flights through Sydney Airport. It is recommended should increase, however, the 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew on flights to and from Mascot should in fact remain. Accommodating more than 80 flights an hour at Sydney would demand more use of the airport's parallel runways and less traffic on the east-west runway, and there are fears as a result of more noise in the suburbs, which obviously everybody will be complaining about. The picture on the Sydney Morning Herald is of a man who is facing charges in the United States. An indictment for supplying sensitive missiles, drone, torpedo and helicopter equipment to the Iran military. He claims he is an innocent man. The Age in Melbourne is leading on a flood. Lots of pictures of people with buckets bailing out their homes there. And the New Zealand Herald and the Press both going very big on their equivalent of New Zealand's Bernard Madoff, a gentleman called Gavin Clifford Bennett, and his $103 million Ponzi scheme has come crashing down. He's now behind bars and facing the prospect of a lengthy jail sentence. For those of us interested, I do recommend that you go and have a look at Mr. Clifford Bennett, because his choice of hat wear is really quite remarkable. Turning now to the weather, let's hear from Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
First up, a look at Europe, and it's quiet towards the end of the week on the weather front across western parts of the continent and most of the Mediterranean. Both Thursday and Friday, sunny in Spain, the south of France, good weather over the Alps too. Eastern Europe and Scandinavia, on the other hand, rather cloudy and cold, even a little snow. So large contrasts across Europe, as you'd expect, in early March. Friday's city forecasts then: in London, 15 degrees with some sunshine. In Zurich, 13 degrees, sunny too. In Copenhagen, 9 degrees, sunny skies. And in Helsinki, minus 1 with light snow flurries. North America and some very rough weather across the US in the last 48 hours. Blizzards in the upper Midwest. In New England, it'll snow through Friday. The bad weather is slowly clearing, but another storm is expected in the same region late Friday into Saturday, so be prepared for possible flight delays in and out of the US northeast over the next 2 days. Friday's city outlook: in Chicago, 5 degrees with a rain and snow mix. In Boston, 3 degrees, partly cloudy. Washington, D.C. is 13 with some sun. And in L.A., a sunny 16, but much warmer here over the weekend. Let's take a look at some warmer climes now in the Caribbean. Havana, hot and tropical, highs here up to 32 degrees in the coming days, which is above normal for the time of the year. Kingston, Jamaica, similar weather. In Cancun, Mexico, a sunny 29. How about Hawaii in Honolulu? Not quite as bright, showers here likely, and about 27 degrees. That's it from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
9 minutes past the hour here. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Tagatia.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Jokosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
After the tragedy of the Costa Concordia off the Italian coast last month, the last thing Costa Cruises wanted was for another of their vessels to get into trouble, which is, of course, what's happened. The Costa Allegra has finally reached dry land after 4 days adrift without power in the Indian Ocean. Passengers described black smoke billowing from the vessel and said they feared a repetition of the Costa Concordia. So what does a firm like Costa Cruises do to drag its reputation back up from the seabed? Well, to hopefully answer that question, I'm joined by Simon Black. He's board director and group strategy partner at Design Bridge. He's a branding expert, and I'm very pleased to say he joins me in the studio now. A very warm welcome to you, Simon. First of all, let's ask by the simplest of questions. Is or are Costa Cruises sunk?
Good afternoon, and thank you for that. Not necessarily. There are many stories of brands that have been where we think perhaps they've been fatally wounded or mortally wounded, but they recover somehow. We can look back just a few years at one of our own brands here in the UK, British Airways, the Bassa strike, the Gate Gourmet strike. We were all going on board, not being fed, couldn't take our luggage with us. Trouble after trouble at Terminal 5, baggage handling, aging fleet, a reputation in tatters. But now they're in the top five.
Nonetheless, you might be able to argue that where BA had problems with logistics and finances and organisation and what have you, this was a brand which specialised in taking people to nice places. But actually, people died as a result of paying their money to Costa Cruises. That surely takes it on to a whole new level.
Yeah, and it can't be trivialised. These tragic events are, you know, just horrific for those people working in the company, around the company, for the company, as well as, of course, those people whose lives were affected by this on an ongoing basis because of their families and their experiences. But there is some hope for the organisation. They obviously need to keep their entire staff on board. If you like, they need to keep everybody facing in the same direction and motivated. And be very sensible about the messages that they send out to the broader general public who may be considering whether or not to even come into the category of cruising. Costa is owned by Carnival, the world's biggest cruise ship operator, and it's just one of their brands. It's one of their, if you like, one of their contemporary brands. It's an entry brand for people who are coming into cruising. So I think what we might see this year is an incredibly difficult trading period. It may be financially fatal for them, who knows, and it's very early days. And time can be an incredible healer. When we all move towards booking our holidays and we see great bargains ahead of us, and we may think that these tragic events were one-offs.
You specialise in building a brand from inside out. Mm. Costa Cruises has been subject to an external buffeting. How different an approach do you therefore have to take?
It's a great question. I think the approach to solving problems, whether they be internal or external, are pretty similar. You have to know what you stand for, and you have to be very clear about that, and you have to know that message you want to take, or that particular truth you have to offer the category you're working in, is relevant and meaningful to your audiences. And if it is, and if you have an offer that's at the right price, in the right place, at the right time, then you're in with a chance. But you've got to be a credible provider in your field. And at the moment, it's their credibility. Lady Bracknell might say, to lose one is misfortune, incredible misfortune, and it was terrible. But to lose two looks like carelessness, and that's the trouble. People can understand misfortune, but carelessness is less forgivable, and that's a trouble.
Do you think, though, that they played a very, very clever card by pinpointing the blame immediately on the captain? Because then you have an example of individual carelessness, which a brand is very quick to seize upon and condemn. Hold him up as the, not necessarily the scapegoat, but as the weakest part of the company. Therefore, the rest of the firm can be seen as being of maintaining higher professionalism, obviously until the second crisis came along.
Yeah, and I mean, the details are very sketchy at the moment as to the reasons for both unfortunate incidents. I would say that allegedly the captain's actions would make him appear to be partly responsible for the result of that activity. But that's an alleged comment at present. And who knows about the second one? It could easily be a dreadful misfortune rather than mismanagement. But I'm sure there are aspects of all of these things that need taking into consideration. What I would say is that to hold him up as a scapegoat, whilst that might to the rest of us appear untasteful and convenient, it might actually be true.
You mentioned the fact that you were talking about BA earlier on, and the fact that BA is the leader in its field and Costa and their parent company are the leaders. Do you think it might be easier for them to take a back seat for a little while and gently regather, accept not being at the top of their game, and then come back in 5 or 6 years' time where we have a more forgiving mind towards them?
Yeah, I think, you know, inevitably I can imagine right now there will be senior level marketing and business strategists at Carnival's headquarters, whether they be in Southampton or the USA, and there will be discussions as to the role of the Costa brand right now. Are we attempting to get people into cruising through Costa at Carnival, or are we going to choose another brand for that to happen? Does Costa need renaming? And if so, when's the appropriate timing for that? And equally, are we attempting now to trade up people who were in this, if you like, entry-level category of cruising through the Costa brand? And do we want to trade them up now to, say, Princess or P&O's offer, which is also in their battery, if you like, of options in their brand portfolio?
The cruise industry is generally a growth area at the moment, isn't it? I mean, it's not impossible to think that Costa could find itself repositioned or that its parent company could direct potential customers somewhere else, but within their company.
Yeah, you make a very good point. In 2009, like all other major industries where discretionary spending was at stake, they lost out. In 2010, we saw the reversal of those figures. And in 2011, they've begun to make significant inroads to getting back to that pre-2008 crash position. So the market is growing. But let's be very clear, at Carnival, whilst they're concentrating through Costa in their European markets, they will also be looking east and be looking to see if joint ventures and operations they have growing, whether that be in Korea, Japan, China, or broader in the region, they'll be looking to find new revenue streams over there. So I suspect there will be contingencies and options, but they need to handle all of this incredibly sensitively.
So you have the chief executive of Costa in front of you. You have 15 seconds to say, I can save your brand. What would you say to him?
I'd say let's look very carefully at finding out what the truth needs to be for Costa over the next 2 years. And once we've achieved that, let's stick to our guns and make sure it's delivered credibly.
And hope that the public forgive you.
Very much so.
Thank you very much. Simon Black, Board Director and Group Strategy Partner at Designbridge, a branding expert. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
You're
listening
welcome
to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The March issue of Monocle marks a very special moment. It's our fifth birthday. In this celebratory issue, we take a close look at how Australia has transformed itself into a resources king and a diplomatic player, why Poland is a new aviation industry high flyer, and we meet a woman still doing very good business in Spain. And there's lots more.
In the affairs section, we look at the style of Kim Jong-un, the motorcade of Hugo Chavez, and we have an interview with Kevin Rudd. We'll also be looking at how Hungary can get itself out of a hole.
In the culture section, we'll be looking at the future of maps and heading over to Sydney, Australia to find out about an interesting media model that still works.
Plus, there's a 16-page review of Monocle's first 5 years, the perfect place to call home in Boston, and five big ideas to change the world. The March issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design hour. It's a show about the things that we live with. Join us as we take you on a tour of the finest furniture, buildings and fashion from around the world. From ramshackle warehouses to luxury runways, hard hat construction sites to the safety of the studio, we bring you the people and products that fill our lives.
These people find a common ground, and you know if they do, that you're probably onto something that everybody in the world might be able to agree with.
Tune in each week to hear about the things that make life better. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
Well, in a moment here on Midori House, we'll be finding out why South Korea is being accused of being a large tropical fruit. But before that, some music. Set Me Free by Sally Seltman.
When I go out at night, I can feel this beating inside. It's like I am holding a knife in my hand. I'm hurting.
And that was Sally Seltman here on Monocle 24 and Set Me Free. 23 minutes past the hour here on Midori House. And we turn now to South Korea and to Tesco. Because it seems that in the Tesco bid for world domination, some battles are tougher than others. Despite successes in economies ranging from Turkey to Thailand, last year the firm pulled out of Japan and now they are having a spot of trouble in South Korea. Tesco's chairman in the country, Lee Seung-han, has described the nation's policymakers as running a watermelon economy. The watermelon reference, for those who aren't entirely sure of this, implies a red or left-wing centre to an ostensibly green or pro-market government. He was referring to the laws which have been introduced to protect four small family-run shops and businesses, and this is restricting where Tesco's can open their large stores. Well, joining me on the line to discuss the merits of this watermelon condemnation is Aidan Foster-Carter. He's Honorary Senior Research Fellow in Sociology and Modern Korea at Leeds University. A very warm welcome, Aidan. Just explain to me how accurate you think this description is that South Korea is watermelon based when it comes to economics.
It's somewhat overstated. Lee Seung-han, who is very good at courting publicity and is good at, he invents his own words sometimes, but he's quite a person for the arresting phrase. Nonetheless, it's understandable why he and Tesco would be annoyed. I should say there's not the slightest chance of them, you know, pulling out of Korea. They've done very well. In fact, they've succeeded in this very difficult market where Walmart and Carrefour gave up and went home. They had $5 billion of sales last year, profits of $300 million. But there is this annoying little fact, which is that currently Tesco's expansion strategy, they've probably built all the big ones that they can. They're known as Home Plus in Korea, by the way. Should say Korea's, you know, the demography is very odd. It's got a Dutch level density plus mountains. So there isn't all that much scope for the big out-of-towners. They've got all of those. And currently, as in other countries, they were expanding by your local neighborhood in the city convenience store. But it's election year in South Korea, which means that what to some degree are sort of permanent things that the Koreans agonize about, which is the fate of how dualistic their economy is, how you've got these vast companies like Samsung and Hyundai and then lots of tiny little ones which are rather struggling. Suddenly that gets translated into policy. The government has decided the mom-and-pop stores must be protected, so there are now ordinances about where you can or cannot set up a local convenience, Home Plus, which basically makes it very hard to do. So he's cross, and so he has sounded off. The regime, the government will probably be quite narked at being called communist. There is, after all, a place called North Korea, rather threatening just across the border, which nominally is communist. This is not a light accusation to make.
No, it's not going to go down terribly well, no. Is it, to be compared with your northern cousins? You're talking about the share that Tesco's has and the fact that it is, you know, it is being stopped from pushing into smaller local branches. But nonetheless, it's the second largest supermarket chain. Home Plus is the second largest supermarket chain in South Korea, isn't it? And and what they've been doing recently is pushing on online sales because of the number of smartphone users. And there's this amazing picture of subway stations which have virtual supermarkets that mean that, you know, cash-rich, time-poor commuters can actually do their shopping. Do you think that Tesco really needs to go into tiny little stores?
You kind of wonder, don't you? Yes, because South Korea, in case people sometimes have the wrong idea, because, I mean, within living memory, when I started working on it, because I'm so old, South Korea was a poor, developing country. They're way ahead of us, you know, 100 megs fat broadband. Their phones do all kinds of stuff that ours don't yet. So, yeah, and online shopping is really taking off. So I think in a lot of ways that's probably the way to go. But nonetheless, there is, as in the Japanese case, if people know Japan, know there's the 24-hour convenience store where you can just get anything physically. If you need it now, as it were, is quite handy. I mean, one of the points that Tesco Home Plus is making is that they would probably open 24 hours if they were allowed to. They're not allowed to at the moment. So people will be better served, and also that people will be better served because their prices would probably be lower than the mom and pop. So it's this eternal thing. We do have a parallel debate in this country, and I'm sure elsewhere as well. The French, for example, have been much more restrictive, haven't they, about allowing the hypermarché to open. You know, do you just let the market rip, even if that brings down sort of small little people that you might, for social reasons, want to preserve? Or do you go the other way? And at the moment, South Korea, say, particularly in an election year, they've got parliamentary elections in April and then presidential ones in December. So even though it's a conservative party that's in power now, supposedly committed to the market, everything's gone all populist. And so you've got measures like this. So I don't know that Tesco will get any joy for a while.
So this is all effectively just boiling down to the age-old argument about restrictions on supermarkets.
It's, yes, with Korean characteristics, in a sense, and also probably because South Korea is a more dualistic economy than most. As I say, Koreans perceive it in a wider context. You have got these vast Korean firms, which, of course, Tesco is not one. It's foreign. They did go in with Samsung originally, which is the largest of the conglomerates, but I believe it's now wholly owned now. So you've got this sort of whales and minnows seems to characterize most of the economy, and this is just a sort of an easy target. It's arguable that if they were going to do anything, there should be some other measures. And they've talked about various things, like which have also been shot down as communist, like why can't the big firms share profits or with their suppliers, or because it's rather difficult probably, or they're often quite mean to their small suppliers, or perhaps share patents and research. That one has sort of flown a bit. I think also the chaebol that the conglomerates have been leaned on to get out of the baking business, although it's because, again, there are small bakeries, though ironically there are some quite big chains which are just bakers. So the question of who is small is quite a complicated one.
Does it make sense to protect small businesses in South Korea?
I find that very hard to answer. I think you would, if you were going to do it, you would have to also take steps to make them more efficient. I mean, they're often very old style. I mean, in a way, it's sort of rather quaint. It's a sort of the thirdy worldy bits that are left. There are these places with this, you know, bags of stuff, higgledy-piggledy all over the place. They wouldn't, you know, these other Koreans may be online, but these ones probably aren't. I mean, maybe I generalize a bit, but it's kind of old style. They, you know, price probably not very competitive, no. So I think, but I mean, obviously you have to tread delicately in all these things. It's also like, you know, protecting the countryside and farmers, which is another big issue. You know, how about 3% of the economy is farmers now, but they make an awful lot of noise as they do in other countries. And you might decide, do you want a farm sector? I mean, in a sense, these ones will actually run and run. But I do have a certain sympathy for Tesco because they've done incredibly well. Fresh octopus twice daily, which is, I certainly don't get in my local Tesco.
Something that we should all treasure.
I think so.
Aidan, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Aidan Foster-Carter. This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. The time is 30 minutes past the hour.
Londonból ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24 です.
De Londres, este é a Monocle 24.
London ist sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λοντόστα, τέμα on Monocle 24.
Λονδρεδάν, μπουρσε Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24.
Coming up in the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be hearing what Hugo MacDonald, our design editor, makes of Helsinki's redevelopment plans. And we'll also be heading to the desert for a spot of camel racing at dawn. All that to look forward to, but before that, here's the latest news with Nick Kelly. Nick.
Thanks, Emma. Syrian authorities will let Red Cross aid workers enter the Baba Amr district of Homs tomorrow, according to a spokesman for the International Committee of the Red Cross. The move came as a three-week army siege of the neighbourhood appeared to be ending with the withdrawal of rebel forces. This just in, Russia and China joined other UN Security Council members today in expressing disappointment at Damascus's failure to allow the UN humanitarian aid chief Valerie Amos to visit Syria and urged that she be allowed in immediately. The United Nations has called for punishment for the US soldiers who burned copies of the Quran in Afghanistan. The United States today said that a number of American staff of US-funded pro-democracy groups had departed Egypt aboard a US government plane following an Egyptian court's decision to lift a travel ban on them. An Iraqi student shot dead his American teacher and then killed himself in northern Iraq's autonomous Kurdish region today after what local authorities described as a personal quarrel. The European Union was set to make Serbia a candidate for membership today in an attempt to promote better government in the Western Balkans as it struggles to emerge from years years of war in the 1990s. Tired passengers left the crippled cruise ship Costa Allegra in the Seychelles capital Victoria today, ending a three-day ordeal in the Indian Ocean after a fire knocked out the vessel's main power supply. And an ebullient-sounding Hugo Chavez said today that he was eating, walking at dawn and recovering fast from an operation on a suspected recurrence of cancer for the Venezuelan president. Those are the top stories at the moment on Monocle 24.
Very much, Nick. I think one of the phrases that Mr. Chavez used was he was now flying like a condor. He's so
good
much
one.
Better.
I'm very happy. He says, I'm fine. My recovery is accelerating.
Brilliant. Well, we wish Mr. Chavez all the best. 33 minutes past the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House, and it is Thursday here, which is Design Day. Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald. I nearly said Hugo Chavez. I'm confusing my Hugos. Hugo MacDonald is in Helsinki, where he's been finding out about the huge redevelopment project taking place over there. Monocle's Katie Bilboa caught up with him earlier on to get his take on it.
I am in Helsinki. I've been here all week, and it has one of the most ambitious urban regeneration projects underway. It's focused on sort of three main areas, but I think in total there's about 30 different projects that are going on simultaneously, which will, over the course of the next sort of 40 years, completely transform Helsinki from a city with a population of about 600,000 into a city that has one sort of close to 1.6 million. In a very short space of time, essentially, Helsinki is going to double in size. And everybody has sort of spoken about how this is fantastic, that Helsinki's sort of moved its ports to a different area to open up new places in the city and make way for the growing population. But actually, what I've noticed, slashing my way around so many of these projects over the last few days, is the fact that it's going to completely change the nature of Helsinki, which, you know, one of the best things about the city is the fact that it's young, mobile, dynamic, it's very engaged with its population. Changes can happen very quickly. Suddenly it's going to be sort of a much bigger city that's sort of less capable of change. And I fear that maybe it's going to change it for the worse, actually.
And what are your other concerns about it then? I mean, because most people would say redevelopment of disused urban areas is a good thing.
Well, exactly. And all the press that's sort of garnered over the last decade since these projects first started being talked about has been very, very positive. I guess my concerns are the fact that almost all the projects are being handled by the city planning department. These are big developers who have sort of just put blocks of housing in all these sort of outlying areas. So huge numbers of sort of residential areas, not even really mixed use, sort of recreational areas, or not a huge amount given over to new office space. So really it's just sort of dumping a massive ring of suburb around Helsinki. And the architecture is not particularly inspiring. I think one of my greatest criticisms is the fact that the city planning department hasn't really engaged with the 200 or so young architecture firms that are based in Helsinki. That's a very high concentration of architecture practices for a very small city. And these young architects are understandably a little bit frustrated that there's so much happening on their home territory that they aren't really being given a chance to contribute to.
And you've visited some of these areas that are going to be redeveloped. What's the atmosphere like there? How does it feel in those areas?
Well, at the moment, it's very snowy and slushy and a little bit bleak, as these huge sort of wastelands tend to be when construction is just about to start. But you don't have to look very far to see that the creative communities, small sort of artist studios, graphic design agencies, bike builders have moved into the warehouses that are currently sort of unoccupied, and they've generated a completely sort of different buzz all of their own. During the summertime when I visited last, there were endless sort of food and music festivals. There were sort of pop-up skate parks, open-air cinemas, sort of all of this land that at the moment is sort of behind hoardings waiting to be developed has really been embraced by the city for a number of sort of trial projects that have meant that young people living in the city have felt that they've got an opportunity to sort of play with it and experiment. And that's the other thing that slightly concerns me, is that 40 years down the line, when these are just huge apartment blocks, you know, the city will have lost this important sort of playground, and maybe the young will feel a little bit less inspired to be living here and a little bit less inspired to sort of try out new things.
And you've mentioned these creative communities that are living in these warehouses and things at the moment. Are these the people that will be moving in to these new developments, or who else will be populating them?
Well, this is the other thing that slightly concerns me. It's yes, Helsinki's population is growing at a very fast rate, one of the fastest in Europe. But it's not growing to the extent where it can, well, it suddenly needs housing space for an extra sort of 500,000 people in 40 years. It will be a lot of people moving from the countryside, which is what the city planning department is aiming for. It's also very ambitiously thinking that Helsinki will give birth over the next few decades to more companies like Nokia that will attract a lot of foreigners coming to live in the city. And also there's a sort of growing amount of Russian people who are migrating to Finland as well. So all of these together sort of will be the people who will occupy these outlying areas. But once again, you know, the fact that there hasn't really been that much allowance for a new sort of shopping district or new theme parks or sort of any type of sort of areas where people can create a sense of community. It is at the moment just planned to be housing. That sort of creates quite a depressing urban feel, and something that the rest of Helsinki does so well, which is mixing its sort of residential space with its mixed use space. So at the moment, sort of looking down from a bird's eye view over what Helsinki might be like in 40 years, it creates a slightly sort of dry, perhaps stagnant city.
And have you had much of a chance to just speak to people on the streets about how they feel about these projects and whether they share the same concerns as you? And I wonder if there's anyone in the city planning department maybe who has the same feelings as well.
Absolutely. I've spent a lot of my time with a lot of the architects, and also going in and out of these sort of creative hubs that have sprung up in the warehouse buildings in the areas that will be developed. And they're all a little bit concerned. They sort of said, obviously, it's great that Helsinki is mobilising itself to expand and sort of make way for new business and new investment, but that maybe it's sort of losing part of its essence, that it will sort of the creative energy that comes about from being such a small, dynamic city with a young population, that it will be diluted. And I spent a lot of time with the mayor a couple of days ago in the afternoon, and I put my concerns to him, and he sort of sucked in his breath and sort of nodded gently, but I think his hands are a little bit tied about how much he can really admit that maybe the city planning department has run away with itself slightly. But having said that, you know, 40 years is a long time, and that can be the frustration with these huge redevelopment projects in cities, is that what you see on paper sort of down the line, decades down the line, when it becomes a reality, can be very, very different things. So my hope is that raising these concerns now, the planning department will start opening their arms to the sort of younger generation of architects who could really contribute something to the way the city grows over the next few decades.
Well, I'm glad we ended on something positive then.
I know. Well, no, let me just clarify, it's not all bad news. Helsinki really is one of the most exciting cities, definitely in Europe and quite possibly even in the world. It's just a little thing that I feel people haven't really spoken up about too much, and it's something that has really struck me on this visit, that perhaps there needs to be a sort of slight change of attitudes and change of direction to make the most of these opportunities and not to waste them.
And that was Monocle's design editor Hugo McDonald talking to Katie Bilbao from Helsinki about the city's huge redevelopment project. In just a moment, we'll be hearing why space is still a frontier worth exploring. So stay with us.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you beautifully shot stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus our regular Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel, food and retail. Premiering this week, novel ideas from Japan.
In the city known to offer the newest and most inventive concepts, Tokyo does it again with Tsutaya Books, a new kind of third space, somewhere that's neither home nor work, and much needed in this dense city.
This and over 250 more films broadcasting on Monocle.com.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
And a warm welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 18 minutes to the top of the hour. A new book hopes to place the space race firmly back on the agenda. The book, Space Chronicles Facing the Ultimate Frontier, claims it's in our political, economic and educational interest to continue investing. This is all despite pressures on the world's governments to direct their tight funds elsewhere. Well, earlier on, I caught up with the book's author, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an American astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium. He spoke to me from Los Angeles, and I began by asking him to explain what drove him to write the book and an accompanying article.
I looked around the world, and I saw that, well, at least America, one of the pioneering countries of space exploration, needs to now hitch a ride with the Russians to send our astronauts into orbit. In fact, hitch is the wrong word, because when you hitch a ride, you get to ride for free. But our seat that we're getting from the Russians, we pay for. And first, that's just kind of embarrassing that we're in that situation. But what I noticed was that, at least here in America, our economy has stagnated. No one is dreaming about tomorrow anymore. They're only just trying to survive the day. And we're looking around the world as our jobs float back overseas. And we've lost our competitive edge intellectually, emotionally, spiritually. And I thought to myself, when did we last have that edge? And it was during the golden era of space exploration. Here in America, we'd identify that as the Apollo era in the 1960s. Of course, the 1960s was a particularly turbulent time in America with the civil rights movement at its peak. There were assassinations, the Cold War, the Hot War in Vietnam. So those were troubled times. But amid those troubled times, we were going to the moon and everything was possible. And that's the mindset I want to bring back. And so I wrote the case for space to jumpstart people's emotions for what value that kind of enterprise can bring back to your society and to culture.
What you've just mentioned there is dreams and the race for space. There seems to be a great romance attached very much to space travel. And it is the hackneyed argument which is wheeled out, which is it is not economically viable to commit so much money to an enterprise which is purely speculative. I mean, we basically cannot afford to dream at the moment. Now, in your article, you dismiss that quite out of hand, don't you?
Oh, yeah, because it has no foundation. It works emotionally, and it makes a good headline, but it just doesn't play out in the actual numbers. Because if you look at the tax dollar here in America and say how much of that tax dollar goes to NASA, it turns out to be one-half of one penny. So one-half of 1% of the tax money people pay goes to the space station, formerly the space shuttles and the Hubble telescope and the Mars rovers and all the astronauts and all the NASA activities. And I'm saying let's double that to 1% of the budget, and that would be enough to go to Mars with people and go on a very real time scale, very nearby, so they'd be big and visible. Compare that 1%. Let's go back to the half percent. Compare that half a percent to how much we actually spend on social programs and on education. We spend 50 times as much money in America on social programs and education than we do on NASA. So anybody who says, why are we spending the money up there when it should be spent down here? It is being spent down here. What, do you want to zero NASA's budget and increase the social program budget by 2% and expect that that's going to somehow make a difference? So I claim that a healthy and vibrant program of space exploration, which in the 60s was driven by war, but we benefited economically from it, I claim let us establish the economic benefit that we stand to gain from that 1% investment. And that economic benefit is people start to innovate again. And it's innovations in science and technology that are the engines of tomorrow's economies. And everyone who has ever embraced the value of science and technology in their culture has led the world, and the UK is no exception to that. One of the earliest embracers of the Industrial Revolution that told you how to convert clever ideas in science and technology into economic gain.
So why do you think at this current time that President Obama, and in fact the entire race for the White House, seems to have no mention of space exploration in it? Because arguably it is a subject that no potential presidential candidate could possibly endorse at a time when things are so tight.
Yeah, because the case has not been made for why that investment will actually give high returns on those money. See, so there are two reasons why you could spend a lot of money even if you're broke. One of them is because someone is trying to kill you and you don't want to die. So when you're at war, money flows like rivers, all right, no matter your financial state. Another reason why people spend money is because there's the expectation that there's economic return. And so that, so the war driver is what got you sort of the Great Wall of China and the Manhattan Project and the Apollo Project. The economic drivers are what gets you the Columbus voyages and the Magellan voyages and the Lewis and Clark expedition across North America. These are very expensive undertakings of a government that reaped huge benefits in return after those investments were made. And not enough people have the foresight to see that. And in the case for space, I'm trying to show that even if you don't care what we discover on the far side of the moon or on Mars, even if you don't care, the act of doing so forces your nation to innovate in ways that can transform your economic stability.
Is there also the need for the United States to, as you mentioned at the beginning of this interview, reestablish itself as not necessarily just hitching a ride on the coattails of Russia and China? Because China now is saying that it can create all kinds of new space developments. Is there not a need, though, the feeling that the United States really just doesn't want to get caught lagging behind again, as it was right at the beginning of the space race?
There is the I don't want to lag behind driver, but it's not as strong a driver as a war driver or the economic driver. I look throughout the history of major funded projects undertaken by civilizations going back thousands of years, and I've only ever found three drivers. One was the war driver, I don't want to die. One was the economic driver, I don't want to die poor. And the third one, which you don't see much today, was the praise of royalty or deity. And that's what got you the pyramids, which are expensive tombstones, or the cathedral building and the church building in Europe. People would respond to the urges of kings and the worship of gods. That doesn't so much drive the activity of nations today in terms of large projects. So that leaves us, if we want to do something big and grand going forward, and we take our cues from the conduct of civilizations that came before us, then this simple concern that you're lagging is not enough of a driver. I'm just cueing off of the conduct of humans that came before me.
That was Neil deGrasse Tyson speaking to me earlier. He's the author of Space Chronicles, and he's endorsing the race for space. It's 10 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll be heading to the desert for a spot of camel racing. But before that, some music. This is Allo Darling from one of their sessions at Midori House just a few weeks ago, and Wonderland. And that was Allo Darling playing at Midori House just a few weeks ago. Their song is Wonderland. An Australian band based in London. They were in the studio just a couple of weeks ago. But you can hear their full session on an episode of Culture. And it's episode 19, so just go to our time shift on the Monocle website. It's 6 minutes to the top of the hour. We end today's Midori House with a trip to the desert, where camel racing has always been big business. The prize is suitably generous. There can be up to $1 million US for the winner. The race happens just after dawn to avoid the heat, but it's not the humans that ride the animals. Atop each camel is a small robot dressed in silks, and at the final furlong, the little robot produces a tiny whip to egg its charge on. Well, to tell us more is Alice Proustel. He's from Live TV in Abu Dhabi. His company covers the camel racing season. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Alex. Tell us, I mean, how big business is this in Abu Dhabi and the associated areas?
Oh, in Abu Dhabi or in all Emirates here in Middle East, or in all in Middle East, there's camel race is a big business. It's a really important sport here.
So when you go out and cover the races, what's it like to go out into the desert? Describe a morning to us.
Yeah, it's quite early in the morning. The races, they start normally by 6 in the morning. So for us, the day starts by 4. the races, they stop by 9:30 in the morning, because then the sun is too hot, and it starts again in the afternoon by 4:30 to 6:30.
And we've read a lot about these automated jockeys. Describe them to us and how they're operated.
Basically, it's a drilling machine, remotable, with a battery on, and the trainers of the camels, they're driving next to the camels on the racetrack, and they have a small remote control, and they steer in the end with this the speed of the camels, because the distances of a race, it's quite long. It's from 8 kilometers onwards, so you need to adjust the speed a bit that the camel come over the time. So there's a trainer, he pushes the button and he pushes the camel in the end.
So the trainer, the act of getting the automated jockey can actually speed the camel up. I mentioned at the beginning of this, there's a whip. What does it look like? Because I've seen a picture of it and it is quite spectacular. Well, as spectacular as a foot tall robot can be. But it does look as if it's pushing the camel on quite severely.
It's a drilling machine with a whip on mounted on, and by whipping to the camel speeds, or it goes slower when the camel feels no whips, and it goes slower and it can go longer. But when the race comes to the end, so they get some hits, and then the camel speeds and will win, hopefully.
Now, recently there has been controversy that they've been using more than whips. That there's been the allegations that stun guns have been used. Have you heard about any of that in Abu Dhabi?
No, it's as far as I know, it's not even allowed. So there are clear rules what is allowed and what is not allowed. It's, in the end, it's only the whip like we know it from a jockey on a horse race.
We understand also that camels, they don't just have a race, but they have beauty contests as well, don't they? Describe them to us.
They have also beauty contests, yeah. So it's like a beauty contest as we know it from Miss World or something. The camels will be shown there, and there's a jury, and they decide what is the nicest camel, and that goes by how they have, what for a face they have, teeth, body, color of the camels. That decides what is the nice camel.
Now, Alex, you've been doing this for quite a long time for the television company in Abu Dhabi. Have you? What do you consider to be a particularly attractive camel or not attractive camel?
That's not seriously. My opinion is they're not really important. I have really no clue what makes the jury deciding what is a nice camel.
But a camel's often more highly prized. It's a very highly prized beast, isn't it? I mean, the prizes are incredible.
Yeah, there are different figures going around. So a camel can be 100,000 dirham, but it's almost $30,000. It can go up to more than 1 million.
Alex Prostel, thank you very much indeed. Sorry to cut you short there. We're out of time for this Thursday's edition of Midori House. We were produced by Katie Bilboa, researched by Fernando Pacheco. In 3 hours, it'll be the Monocle Daily. Join Andrew Tuck and Chloe Potter. They'll be talking happiness. But from all of us here, goodbye.